Good morning. I want to apologize. This weekend, I came up with a cold. I think I'm going to be okay this morning, but I'm going to avoid shaking hands. And if I go to the potluck, I'm not going to touch any of the utensils or anything, because I'd like to share some scripture, but I don't want to share anything else that you don't want. We're going to be talking about this morning cultural seepage, the danger of worldliness infiltrating homes and churches. So we are to be in a world, but not of the world. And that presents a challenge. Some people's idea is that disciples should be away from the world, hide behind the walls of a monastery, and you can't be a light to the world like that. But we're also challenged, and this is our theme text for today, so please open your Bible to Romans chapter 12. Theme text for this lesson, that is. In the book of Romans, after Paul has spent chapter after chapter talking about the problem of sin and the solution of Christ and salvation through grace, he switches at the end of the book to our obligation, and it is this. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your, some translations say spiritual worship, others say service. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, which way is the influence working? In my home, in your home? Is the influence of the world overtaking my home, or is my home being a light to the world? It's the same with churches. You'll see churches that are dead as can be because they have let the world overtake the church. They still have songbooks with spiritual words in them, but there's no spirituality in the church. There's no submission to God. They may be flying rainbow flags and having all kind of things going on because they've let the world overtake them. I want to ask you, because the younger classes are out this morning, is that correct? Yes, so this is a class, so I'm going to ask for some participation then. When you think of the churches that Paul wrote to in the New Testament, Paul's epistles, which one was the most messed up? Which one had the most problems? Corinth, yes, the church at Corinth. And what I want us to do in this lesson, it's a two-part lesson. First, I want us to think about Corinth, the culture of Corinth, and the church at Corinth. And then I want us to switch and think about churches today, here and now, in our culture, and see if in some ways we make the same mistakes that they did. Because when you're thinking of the church at Corinth, are you ever kind of shocked and surprised at how bad they were? It's like, what are they thinking? Well, what we're going to see is they were thinking like Corinthians. You and I read Corinthians and we're like, that's ridiculous. But except for one exception in 1 Corinthians 5, what they're doing is not ridiculous in their culture. They're just acting like Corinthians, which is exactly what they were not supposed to be doing. But that's the danger. So, first century example, and then we'll come and talk about us today. So the church at Corinth, Paul writes to the church at Corinth. He had left with Paul and Silas. He picked up Timothy, later picked up Luke, dropped him off in Philippi, came down about 50 AD to Corinth, which was the capital of Achaia. Our letter, 1 Corinthians, is written about 5 years later. At this time, Paul is in Ephesus, and he's received a letter from the church at Corinth. And in that letter, there are things that he needs to respond to. So in chapter 7, he says, "Now concerning the things you wrote about." And so they had written about marriage, eating meat sacrificed to idols, spiritual gifts, and then also contribution is introduced with this phrase, "now concerning." I think each time we see the phrase "now concerning," he's going through and answering things in their letter. But was the letter the only information Paul had about Corinth? There was another source of information about Corinth. What was that? Yes, the household of Chloe had reported to him what was going on. And there's a difference between the letter and the report. In the letter, they had not mentioned, "We have a man sleeping with his father's wife. We're suing each other. Somebody's getting drunk at the Lord's Supper." Those things weren't in the letter, but they're in the report. Divisions in the church, sexual immorality, report of the Lord's Supper being abused. And so the reason 1 Corinthians isn't a long theme like Romans or Hebrews is because there's all these different problems to address and questions to answer, which included problems to address. So let's take a look at the culture of Corinth. To understand Corinth, let's make a few historical notes. There was an old Corinth, and some of our quotes are from old Corinth. And then there was and it was destroyed in 146 BC. The new Corinth, which is the capital city of Achaia, was rebuilt by Julius Caesar in 44 BC. A lot of our quotes will be from that time. And when I say quotes, I'm going to be sharing with you, there's a book, it's called St. Paul's Corinth. It's one of my favorite little books. And I like it because it's a collection of ancient writings, pagan writers who visited the city of Corinth and told people at their time what they saw there. And so that gives us insight as to what it was like. And in both cases, it was affected by the geography. So the geography is this: sailing below this section of land was dangerous. There were a lot of shipwrecks down there. If any of you are familiar with the Antithrica mechanism, it was found sunk down below there from a shipwreck. Paul, in these lower areas, of course, was in a storm, in a shipwreck. It was safer to come in from one side or the other. And so Corinth had two seaports, one on this side and one on that side. Small ships would be rolled over the isthmus on logs. Big ones would be unloaded, brought over here, and put into the other ship. What would that mean for a city to have these two seaports? How might that affect the nature and the economy of the city? Yes, there's a lot of money coming in. All these goods, if you're going through Corinth, it's going to get some of that. So it's going to have a lot of wealth. And do you think most of the money is going to the poor guys pushing the little boats over the log? No, so you're going to have some hard manual laborers and some slaves and some poor people. You're going to have some rich people. And you see, of course, reference to that in chapter 11. But also with ships at sea always coming in, think of seaport cities in the United States, New Orleans, San Francisco. Do these usually sound like family-friendly areas? No. You've constantly got sailors getting off of boats looking for the type of things that sailors are looking for. And that dominated the nature of the city. So here's the book, St. Paul's Corinth, and it has citations from 33 Greek and Latin authors from the first century BC to the second century. And it just tells what they saw. Now, these are not generally believers in Christ. These are just pagan writers talking about the city. And so let's look at a few of these. In the Corinthian church, sexual immorality. Strabo describing old Corinth, said the temple of Aphrodite was so rich that it owned more than 1,000 temple slave prostitutes. So it was a religious city. They had a bunch of idols and temples, and here's the temple to the goddess of love, and it's got 1,000 prostitutes that serve it. It was on account of these women that the city was crowded with people and grew rich. Aristophanes, this is writing long before, that this Greek word here, Corinthi Zestai, I probably mispronounced that, act like a Corinthian, that meant practice fornication. At the time of Plato, Corinthian chora, Corinthian girl, that meant prostitute. I want you to imagine that Indianapolis was such a wicked city that the word, oh, she's an Indianapolis girl, meant prostitute. That's the nature of this city. And Paul went to this city and spent a year and a half there and built a church. And then he left, but what has happened in between? Culture has seeped back into this city. Lawsuits. Dio Chrysostom talked about visiting the Isthmian Games, which are held just north of Corinth. And he said, the lawyers innumerable perverting judgment. And this quote, attributed to William Barclay, I'm not sure it's in the book, I think I got this quote somewhere else, said the law courts among the Greeks were in fact one of their chief amusements and entertainments. Going to law was intricately bound up with Greek life. The Greeks were in fact famous or notorious for the love of going to law. And of course, we see that in Corinth, 1 Corinthians 6. Idolatry. There was the Temple of Apollo, there was Octavia Temple, and this is an example from Murphy O'Connor's book. This particular quote, I think, is from a different city, but it gives you the type of thing. Here's a dinner invitation. Hierius asks you to dine in the room of Seraphion, that's the goddess Lepion, at a banquet of the Lord's surface tomorrow at the 11th from the 9th hour. And so suppose your trade guild, you know, they're having a dinner at the idol temple. It's going to be prime rib. Your boss is going to be there. You know, your coworker is going to be there. Your cousin's getting married, and they're having an idol temple feast. Or you're invited to someone's house to a feast. And another one of these I've seen mentions, you know, we're going to have chicken that was offered to this god and stuff. This was part of their culture. They liked that. You got a lot of restaurants just over here within a mile this way. So many restaurants there. And I imagine you've enjoyed a number of those restaurants. Well, for the Corinthians, these idol temples, that's a big deal to them. That's part of their social core of life. They want to do this. But they're idol temples. And so what do we see in Corinth? They're trying to justify, we're smart enough, we know enough that we ought to be able to keep doing that. That's their culture, they want to keep doing it. This one's very interesting. How would you describe the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians? Think about that for a minute. The first four chapters of 1 Corinthians. In chapter 1, verse 10, what does Paul say? It's reported that there are divisions among you. Some of you are saying what? I'm of Paul, somebody else. I'm of Cephas. I'm of Apollos. And he's saying, I wasn't crucified for you. You should be following Christ. And he talks about their view toward teachers for four chapters. But something else enters in over and over and over in those four chapters. What is it? References to something very Greek.
Wisdom.
Yes, the Greek word being sophia. What is the word philosophy from? Philo, love, sophia. Philosophy is the love of wisdom. And over and over and over in the first four chapters, he's warning them about being enamored with Sophia, Sophia, Sophia. This is interesting. This is, you had, philosophy was a big thing at Athens, which is not very far away. You had the Cynics, the Stoics, the Epicureans. By the way, the motto of the Epicureans was eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's why in 1 Corinthians 15, under Greek influence, the Greeks didn't like the idea of resurrection. You recall Paul at Athens. They listened until he said resurrection, and then they were done. It didn't, I won't go into why it didn't fit, but it just didn't fit Neoplatonic thought at all. So when he's responding to, they've been listening to some people, bad company corrupts good morals. And he says, if there's no resurrection, then might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But there is a resurrection. So lots of Greek reference. But this is interesting. This is Dio Chrysostom. And he's describing at the Isthmian Games. That was the time when one could hear crowds of wretched sophists. So what's a sophist? A philosopher, you know that. Wretched sophists around Poseidon's temples shouting and reviling one another, and their disciples, as they were called, fighting with one another. You see that image? What are the big sports rivalries here in Indiana? I guess Indiana, Kentucky, right? Maybe. If you get over into Illinois, you got, you know, the Packers and the Bears when I was a kid and everything. You get in the area where there's rivalry, and wow, people, they really have their loyalties, and they, you know, they're ready to go. For the Greeks, here's a sophist, and he's got his disciples. Here's a sophist, he's got his disciples. Here's a sophist, he's got his disciples. And what are the disciples of these sophists doing? Fighting and arguing with each other about which one was best. What do you see in chapter 1? These Corinthians, now that they've become Christians, they've brought that culture into the church. I'm of Paul. Oh, I'm of Apollos. He's better. Oh, I'm of Cephas. Over and over and over. So Paul writes to the church at Corinth. And we read it. And in one case, they actually outdid the immorality of their neighbors. What was that? Yeah. The man was, which Paul said, even the Gentiles don't do that. But most of the other cases, this is common Corinthian behavior. You and I look at it and appropriately are disgusted and aghast. How can people claiming to be disciples of Christ be behaving like this? But it was something that seemed normal to them. Why? Yeah, it's all around them. And that's not what God calls us to. That's not what Paul had called them to. That's why Corinthians doesn't sound like Philippians. You know, it's encouraging and wonderful. It's you got to fix this and fix this and fix this. You can't be doing these things. So, for the second part of the lesson, what if Paul wrote to us today? Are there any things that are part of our culture today that Paul would be aghast at and think, what are you thinking, that seemed perfectly normal to us? Because being in this culture, we've just come to accept it. Or even before going back to Paul, let's just take on some general principles and moralities. Do you remember your grandparents, if you had godly grandparents? Possibly, do you remember their parents? if they were brought back in time today and they looked around, would they be just saying, wow, this is all wonderful? Or would they have a lot of raised eyebrows and saying, what are people thinking? So our challenge is not to be defined by our culture. Our job, let's read it again in Romans chapter 12. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God. Verse 2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. What do you think are some things that are in our culture today that too easily we can let affect our families and thus affect the church? There's a bunch of them. What are some things that come to your mind?
Entertainment.
Yes. And maybe on two levels. The amount of time we spend seeking entertainment and the nature of the entertainment that we choose. I remember being on a meeting up in Maine, and I've asked to go over to somebody's house for dinner. And it's this older couple, like, you know, the age of my grandparents or something. And I knock on the door. They say, come in. I walk in. He's in his Lazy Boy. She's in her Lazy Boy, watching a soap opera, watching a bedroom scene, and they're just sitting there watching it. And it's like they hardly even spoke to me. But you know what? That's typical American behavior. Very good point. What else? Yes. The way some people dress today, if they had dressed that way 100 years ago, the vice squad would have picked him up for prostitution. A friend of mine, one time he had daughters, and he went into the mall and he was looking, you know, at one of the ladies' shops for clothes. And he asked the clerk, I thought it was a pretty good question. He said, excuse me, he said, do you have anything other than prostitute clothing? And I thought it was a pretty good question. Yes, brother. Okay. Let's talk about that one for a minute. What's the first mentioning of clothes in the Bible? Yes. And so what did Adam and Eve do? Yeah, they took some fig leaves and sewed them together. And sometimes you'll see a painting, there's one or two fig leaves. No, they sewed them together, and the Hebrew word is like a girdle or something that you would wear around you. So they made enough fig leaves to surround their midsection, which is probably more than a lot of people wear at the beach. What did God do? He put some clothes on. Look at Exodus chapter 28 with me, please. Now, this is the old law, and this is specifically about the garments for the priests. We're not supposed to, in general, dress like the high priest with a breastplate here with all the different stones and the bells and the all that stuff. But there's something interesting in this text. Somebody read verse 40, and let's notice what this item of clothing is and what the purpose is. Exodus 28, verse 40.
For Aaron's sons, you shall make tunics. You shall also make sashes for them, and you shall make caps for them for glory and for beauty.
What was the purpose of the cap and the sash? Glory and beauty. It's just decoration. Now, look at verse 42. You shall make for them linen undergarments for what? To cover their nakedness, to cover their naked flesh. And it says, they shall reach from the hips to the thighs. That's a different item of clothing. This isn't for glory and for beauty. This isn't for decoration. This is for decency. Have caps and sashes for glory and for beauty, but have this undergarment from the hips to the thighs to cover their nakedness. From the hips to the thighs, is that inclusive or exclusive? Does that mean from below the hips to above the thighs? That wouldn't make any sense. From the hips to the thighs, like when Job had boils, but I don't think it meant his head and his feet didn't have boils. It meant it was all over. This is inclusive. If you look up in like ISBE, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, you can see an artistic representation of the different items. And so it's something about like a modern pair of men's basketball shorts. You know, it goes from here to here. Now, if you're not this old, you've probably seen it. Do you remember the basketball shorts they wore back in the 70s? It's ridiculous, you know. But that's what they wear now. That's this type of length. Yet our culture accepts what? Anything. For example, if a young lady is at home and she's getting dressed and she's in her underwear and somebody rings the doorbell, would she answer the door? No. But if she's going down to the pool or the beach, what's she got to put on in our culture? Yes, often less than what she would have been dressed in and embarrassed to answer the door. Why? Oh, well, it's at the beach. I'm swimming. Two questions. Do we have any verse in the Bible about somebody getting dressed to go swimming or go to the beach? Yes, we do. Where? John 21. Turn there. Verse 3, this is after the resurrection. They're back up at Galilee. And Simon Peter says what in verse 3? And what did some of the other guys say? We'll go with you. So this is a group of men out on a boat working at night. They're not in public. It's just men. And so they've taken off their cloaks. And they would have been in their undergarment, which would have been a wraparound thing that covered this area. In the morning, somebody on the beach calls to them, and then they realize it's Jesus. And now it's daytime, and they're about to be out of the boat on the beach and over there where the Lord is. And what does Peter do? In the middle of verse 7, when Simon Peter heard it was the Lord, he girt his coat about him, for he was unclothed, and he cast himself into the sea. He put some clothes on to go swimming and go to the beach because he was going to be coming up in public and over where his Lord was. You can see all sorts of examples of these double standards. Here's another one. Holiday parties. At least this used to be the culture. There would be a holiday party. You know, the business, the boss would throw a party. Everybody would go, and there would be a lot of drinking, and everybody brings their spouse, and there's drinking and dancing. And who do people dance with? They start dancing with other people's spouses, right? So they're drunk and holding somebody else's spouse, and it's all okay because it's what? It's the holiday party. Try that in June. You know, walk over there, be holding on to the boss's wife in June, and he's like, what are you doing? I remember there was an Ann Landers letter years ago, and there was a girl and she wrote to Ann Landers because she was distraught. Her grandmother had misunderstood. She said, "My grandmother is hard of hearing. Me and my boyfriend were dancing, and my grandmother walked into the room and didn't hear the music and just saw what was going on and was upset with what we were doing, but she didn't hear the music. What difference does it make?" So we need to stop thinking about, oh, this is what you do at the holiday party. This is what you do at the beach. This is what's in style this year. And be transformed. What's some other things about our culture? Oh, let me make one more point on that. The security envelope that you get in the mail, right? What's exposed? What should be exposed? Your name and address, so the post, but your social security number, your bank info and everything is not his business, so that's not revealed. The back of the bacon at the store. The purpose is to expose it, to show you. Don't dress like you're for sale. All right. Any other comments on that before we move on? What's another part of our culture?
Feminism.
Yes. So there is so much. And you see gender. And it started with one thing, and that went to another and another and another and another. And now we've got just this ridiculousness. I saw something, so this is beyond feminism. We'll come back and touch on that in a minute. But somebody asked a question the other day, because finally there's being some correction on all this transgender thing and everything. A few weeks ago, a woman who was mutilated by a doctor when she was a young girl won $2 million in a lawsuit because they very quickly, and they used on her mother the same line that's always used, do you want a living son or a dead daughter? And they pushed that on so many people, and the girl won. I'm not big on lawsuits, but I tell you what, you put me on a jury where one of those girls has been treated like that, I don't mind how many zeros you put at the end of that check. And there's starting to be some reaction, and somebody said this, and I thought, wow. There are now in, and I'm gonna come back to feminism, but I wanna touch on this for a minute. In Britain, they refused to, this happened maybe a year or two ago, to do trans surgeries on minors. And recently, some higher-ups in the elite circles are now challenging it here in the United States. It's about time. But somebody asked this question. Which of the major universities, which of the major medical schools 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, stood up and said, no, men cannot get pregnant? None of them. We put way too much trust in this country, in the universities, in the experts and everything, and they have exposed themselves on something as obvious as biological order. For years, when the baby's born, it's a boy, it's a girl. And it had gotten to the point where, well, who knows? We'll have to wait until they tell us. And none of the major universities and medical schools would stand up and say, no, that is not right. While they said, listen to the science, it was fairy tale. And it started with feminism and rejecting the roles that God gave. So let's go back to Genesis. By the way, there are some feminists who are very opposed to the transgender movement, and I'm glad, because you know it's circled around to ridiculousness. If you're really wanting, you know, for girls to have good opportunities, then you don't want men being able to compete in the girls' sports and men being able to invade the girls' locker rooms. But the ridiculousness just got ridiculous. So Genesis chapter 2. Somebody read for us, please. No, Genesis 1. Somebody please read verse 26. No, 27.
So God created man in his own image. He created him in the image of God. He created them male and female.
Male and female. And when we get to chapter 2, we see which one was made first. Which one was made first? Male. And the female was made to be a helpmeet to the male. And when Paul talks about the roles of gender in 1 Corinthians 11, 1 Corinthians 14, 1 Timothy 2, he goes back to this order that existed from the beginning. And look at the curses. After they have sinned, what do the and the excuses, and by the way, let's just take a note there. When they sinned, they tried to hide. After they got caught, they started making excuses. Human behavior has not changed a whole lot. But when the curses came, what did the curses on the woman, what was the realm of her curses? Yeah, it was domestic. In relationship to her bearing children and her husband, what was the role of curses for the man? Yes, by the sweat of your brow, you're going to have to provide food and you're going to face thorns and thistles. Now, I'm not saying there's not overlap, but the woman's realm was a domestic realm. Her children, her husband, God made her to be a nurturer. The man's curses relate to his role as provider. That does not mean that a woman can't contribute to the prosperity of a home. The worthy woman, did she contribute to the prosperity of the home? Yes. What are some ways she did that? Yes. She considered a field and bought it and planted a vineyard. And she's working on her loom or whatever, and she's making garments that she delivers to the merchants and they sell them. And her household is in good shape. They're prepared for winter. They're dressed in scarlet. She's helping take care of her house well. She fears the Lord. Where is she centered? Is the center of her life her career out somewhere else? She's centered in her family and home. Yes, she's contributing to the income of the family, but you see where she's centered. Aquila and Priscilla, which one worked in tent making? Both. So it's not wrong. The point is, it's not wrong for a woman to work or bring income into the home. But with feminism, we also bought into the idea of two people fully employed, both pursuing careers, bringing in all this money. And what does that leave undone? Yes. Who's taking care of the children? And so our society had an answer for that. What was it? Daycare. Now, I want to say a couple things about daycare. I've known people who wanted to do good daycares, but I'm just going to give you a couple of horror stories. One lady that was running a daycare, and I talked with her, she said, the reason I started this, she said, I got out of the daycare I was in before. She said, my job, here's three things she told me about. We were not allowed to hold the babies. They would lay there and cry and cry and cry and bang their heads against the crib, and we were not allowed to pick them up. Because the boss said, if you pick them up, they'll want more of that. She said, my job was to scribble crayon markings on color pages so that when the parents came, we could say, look what your child did. And she said another time, one of the daycare workers had hit one of the child and left a bruise. And she was told, when they come, you say he fell off the slide. I know an older couple, they love the kids that they take care of. The older couple, they have a small daycare in their home, like maybe 5 or 6 kids. And sometimes they love those children more than the parents do. They insist on meeting the parents. They have parents that want to hire them to watch their kids that don't want to take time to meet them. They don't even want to meet with them. They just, it's like ordering Uber Eats, you know, or something. Just, I don't want to talk to them. Just watch my kids. They had one episode where a 6-year-old was sexually using a 1-year-old in a way that would have never occurred to a 6-year-old. And they came upon it, and I'm going to try to avoid any graphicness here, but they realized the chain of events. The 6-year-old was from a family that would use a babysitter that was from a family in the neighborhood where the parents would have relations in front of their teenagers. So you see where the perversions went in that society. Here's my point there. Turning your children over to some people watching them for money doesn't mean that they care about your children. Now, some do. This older man and woman run this, they do. And they did the right thing. But their supervisors, I don't remember if it was corporate or state, you know what they were advised? When this happened, they were said, keep it quiet, don't say anything about it. How many times has that happened? How many daycares out there are things like this happening and nobody's saying anything because the supervisor's saying, hush it up, cover it? They didn't. And good for them that they didn't. They told every parent what happened and gave those parents the option to get the children out of that daycare. And the area where that child had gotten to, they made that area inaccessible. They did other and removed that child, of course, and good for them. But my point is this. Yes, there are some people that will give good daycare. There are some people that really care, but there are a lot that don't. And generally speaking, nobody is going to love your child as much as you should for money. And we've got to stop this idea of just how much money can we get at the sacrifice of our children. Titus chapter 2, and then I think our time will be about up. Verse 3, aged women, in like manner, be reverent in demeanor, not slanderers, nor enslaved to much wine, teachers of what is good, that they may train the young women to love their husbands, love their children, be sober-minded, pure, workers at home, kind, being subjection to their own husbands. We have a culture that celebrates material success and money and everything else. And let me tell you, if we spend so much time away from our children making all that money, what will it have gotten us? And there's one thing you can't buy. You cannot buy the time back that you wish you had with your kids. Let's use that time. I'll give one last comment. My dad likes to say this. What's better, a spoon or a fork? Depends on what you're eating, right? If it's soup, spoons are just better at that. Forks are better at other things. Men and women are different, and thank God they are. Would any of us guys want to live in a world with no women? In the first place, we wouldn't be here, and nobody else would be here later. But, ooh, even if for a while, just us guys and no women, I don't want to live in that world. Should women want to live in a world with no men? No, God made men and God made women. And there will be responsibilities that overlap and they help each other. I had a friend of mine said, I've never changed a diaper. Shame on him. Shame on him for that. But let's respect the fact that God made men to be men and women to be women. And we need to help our kids as we're growing, helping them not to be modeled by what this world says they ought to be, but let's help our boys be becoming men and our girls becoming young ladies serving God. Thank you so much for your attention.